Let's talk about Medi-Cal. You have a choice, and Molina makes it easy, especially when it comes to the care you need. So let's talk about you, about making your life easier, about extra help to manage your health. Let's talk about your needs now and for the future. Nobody knows Medi-Cal better than Molina. It starts with a phone call. Call 866-420-5330 or visit meetmolinaca.com. Let's talk today.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Maybe that's why Bluehost has been recommended by WordPress.org since 2005. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to Bluehost.com/Wondersuite. That's Bluehost.com/Wondersuite.
This is Smarter Collaboration, the series that explores how gutsy leaders bring diverse thinkers to the table and create breakthrough outcomes. Hosted by Harvard scholar Dr. Heidi Gardner and business executive Ivan Matviak, they lean into their experiences of teaching at Harvard Law and Harvard Business Schools, authoring best-selling books on collaboration, and leading teams across financial services and consumer goods sectors. Today's program features the incomparable Shelley Archambeau, veteran board member and best-selling author of Unapologetically Ambitious. Now here's Heidi and Shelley talking about board-level collaboration. Enjoy.
Welcome, everyone. Today's guest is Shelley Archambeau, one of Silicon Valley's first female African-American CEOs. Formerly an exec at IBM and CMO at two public companies, Shelley was recruited to be the CEO of a then-struggling Silicon Valley startup, which is now MetricStream, a recognized global leader in governance, risk, and compliance software solutions. She currently serves on the boards of Verizon, Nordstrom, Roper Technologies, and Okta. Her debut book, Unapologetically Ambitious, Take Risks, Break Barriers, and Create Success on Your Own Terms, was featured as one of the best business books of 2020 by Fortune. Shelley is also a fellow Wharton alum, like my co-author, Ivan. So Shelley, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I've been looking forward to it, Heidi.
Fantastic. So let's kick off with some ideas from your book, Unapologetically Ambitious, which, by the way, I adore. You recount in the book how you overcame the challenges you faced as a young Black woman, a wife, a mother, managing your personal and professional responsibilities while climbing the ranks at IBM, and then into your position as CEO. So I'm super curious, what role did Smarter Collaboration play in your growth and your success?
Oh, it played a huge role, frankly, in everything. I'm a big believer that no one accomplishes anything of significance all by themselves. No one. So when I think about my own life and career trajectory, you know, I asked for help, got support, reached out to others, included others in everything I did. Even deciding to be a CEO. It's not like I sat there and suddenly, bing, it just hit me, I want to be a CEO, right? That came after conversations with my guidance counselor, right, who helped me understand what a CEO, what a business was, right? And how leading a business was kind of like clubs, and therefore I liked leading clubs. So I thought, okay, I'll lead a business. But every step of the way, I've always tried to reach out, learn from others, support others.
You know, it's interesting to hear you say that and admit it, because for a lot of people, it does feel like an admission. When they have to turn to other people for help and advice and input, they're by definition admitting that they're not brilliant at absolutely everything, and that makes them feel vulnerable. So what advice do you have for people who feel like they need to be projecting this image of perfection all the time?
Well, first of all, I will tell you that being vulnerable itself is actually a side effect of being ambitious, because you can't do it all by yourself. And therefore, if you feel that asking for help or letting people, you know, that maybe I don't know absolutely everything is feeling vulnerable, then that is actually part and parcel. What I tell people is asking for help, reaching out to others for input, for perspective, is actually a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness. Because what it says is, you know what you know, and you know what you don't know. And frankly, that's much more important than acting like you know everything, because you don't.
100%. You know, the funny thing is, as I listen to what you just said, it just really resonates. Being vulnerable is sort of the flip side of being ambitious. And yet, you know, I've had these experiences in the Harvard classroom, standing in front of 100 executives, and it didn't feel like being vulnerable was necessarily the place I wanted to be. So I suppose it's partly about picking when and with whom you show that vulnerability.
Agreed.
That makes sense. I mean, we have a chapter in our book called The Illusion of Inclusion. So we call out the mistakes that many organizations make when they use an approach that's more akin to tokenism than it is to really building an inclusive organization, right? They claim we have X percent of this type of person in our ranks, in our board, whatever. But if they're not truly reaching into that person's experience and depth of perspectives and valuing the difference, that it is sometimes worse than not having people on board at all. And in your view, in your experience, how are organizations getting better at making sure that they are truly inclusive and not just having representation?
Mm-hmm. So I think a couple things. One is employees are actually speaking up a whole lot more on this topic, so that it's hard for a company not to be inclusive and not know it, right? Because employees are saying it. They say that they feel that they're included, or they feel like they belong, or they feel all of those things. But before, I don't think employees felt they had either the right or the authority or the option, right, necessarily to say how they felt. I think employee resource groups and things like that have helped lend voice, which is definitely helpful. So yeah. That's number one. Number two, you know, there's studies out there that show that the more inclusive, more collaborative an organization is, the better they perform. I mean, Babson College has published one. I can't remember when it came out, a couple of years back, but it talked about collaborative companies and organizations perform 5X, right, better than those that aren't.
Yeah.
So this is something that everyone should be striving for. And if your performance is not where you want it to be, first one of the early places you can look at, well, how well are we actually collaborating? How well are we unleashing the full breadth of talent and capability that we have within our organization? Because most times they just aren't.
Absolutely. I mean, our research, you know, the first chapter in our book is called The Business Case for Smarter Collaboration, right? We are documenting exactly what you're saying. And it's the financials, it's the revenues and profits, but it's also risk mitigation and a whole host of other kind of performance outcomes that demand that people get those different perspectives. So you're 100% right. And yet it's still, you know, enormously problematic. So maybe we dig into that later. But you have experience that so few other people do when it comes to sitting on corporate boards. You're sitting on multiple boards. You've sat on a range of different kinds of boards. And early on, someone was astute enough to point out to me that boards of directors are almost a microcosm of this kind of smarter collaboration that we've been researching. So you've got incredibly experienced experts with different kinds of backgrounds coming together, ostensibly because they are so much more powerful together as a board than any of them are as individuals. And yet our research and others have shown that oftentimes board members, directors, hesitate to really challenge one another. They don't kind of stir up the pot. They're overly deferential to their fellow board members. And as we were just saying, that doesn't get the most out of people. So what's your word of wisdom or your perspective on how, even when you're with people whom you respect and admire, you still can engage with them and challenge and debate them?
Yeah. So, first of all, I actually don't think it's respectful when you actually sit in a room in which people have included you, in which they are paying you to participate, and you actually are not sharing your knowledge, your perspective, raising risks. So, I mean, I'm sorry. People say, well, I'm just being deferential to my board. It's like, no, you are just not doing your job. So I see that as the space of what you're supposed to be doing. Now, I do think board leadership can encourage and or diminish that. So I think leadership is so important by either the chair or the lead director in ensuring that people's voices are heard and are also sought out.
Yes.
You know, I think the key role that you play is saying, okay, we hear three people talking. We have another six people on the board, right? And it's actually asking so-and-so, right? What perspective do you have? Blah, blah. Do you agree with it? Right? It's really pulling it all out if it's not happening. And by doing that, then people realize, oh, you do want my voice.
Yes.
And then you don't have to continue to pull it out, right? The next few times, they'll actually offer it. The other thing is how your feedback is received. So if you put across an idea and people immediately dismiss it, right? They don't have any intellectual curiosity around it, you know, et cetera, that also diminishes.
Hearing some perspectives from you about what else it takes, you know, one thing is asking people for their contributions. What's the next step you do, you know, as part of a board, perhaps, to genuinely appreciate and use what somebody contributes?
So, for instance, at the end of the board meeting, you know, best practices, the next board meeting, the CEO starts with, okay, here's what I heard last board meeting, right? Here are the actions we're taking. And it may be, and this one, we're not taking the action. We heard you, but we're not doing, right? Et cetera. So it's, and to me, that's best practice, right?
Yeah.
Always sum up with, okay, here's what we left off. Here's what we heard, right? Et cetera. I also think it's best practice at the end of the meeting for the lead director or chair to actually survey the room a bit to say, okay, right? How do we feel about the meeting? Are there things that we wished for? What are we concerned about? Right? What are we excited about? I mean, there's different ways of asking the questions to actually get that feedback, but it's really about fostering an environment in which people know that your voice is desired.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard a lot of directors talk about having an explicit focus on the process and the atmosphere as opposed to just the content.
Yeah, I think it's important personally.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting, Shelley, because for a lot of people that feels, quote unquote, touchy-feely, and yet we know that you can't actually get the hardcore results unless you engage in these kinds of conversations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I joined a board once, and one of the practices they did is at the end of the meeting, literally in executive session, each went around the room and every board member shared, right, what they were excited about, what they were concerned about, a couple points, but you went around. And what happened in doing that is people got used to, okay, it's going to happen. So let me focus, let me make sure. And then everything, right, surfaces. I've actually brought that practice to other boards. But I do think the environment is important because if people feel that their voice is not desired, right, and that they realize, then fine, they're going to follow the culture, right? The culture of the board is important.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's some pretty compelling evidence to show that the culture that gets fostered in that boardroom actually permeates the executive suite, and then guess where it goes from there? Throughout the organization, right? So,
yeah. So
this is not soft stuff that we're talking about.
Not at all.
One of our other pieces of research I conducted with Dr. Randall Peterson at the London Business School, and we published it in Harvard Business Review. We called it Back Channels in the Boardroom. And so in here, we explored the very common practice that, say, a board chair will use in soliciting behind-the-scenes opinions from people and canvassing. And it makes complete sense that no competent chair wants to walk into a room cold, not knowing where the directors stand. Mm-hmm. And yet what we showed is that it has really unintended consequences because some people's voice carries much louder in those dyadic behind the scenes conversations. And so how do you get the right balance of making sure, you know, you're connecting with the chair or the lead director, but making sure there is a wide enough spread of inputs when you're not in the room, so to speak.
You have to have conversations and you cannot have them in the room. So you're going to be reaching out to people, et cetera. Depending upon the nature of them, you might just do them differently. For instance, on one board, we were trying to get some pretty serious, you know, feedback and perspectives from board members. And so what we decided is two directors would talk to a board director because we each hear differently, right? And it would balance. So my bias or their bias or whatever, right, wouldn't out overweigh one versus the other. So if it's super critical, super important, because if you have a bias, you know, I'm always biased towards blah, 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 blah. So here's what I heard, right? But call me on it if I've leaned too far in. I mean, just put it out there. It all comes down to communication.
You know, this idea, Shelley, of put it out there, right? That might be your new mantra, put it out there. I'm hearing you say, put it out there, be vulnerable and admit where you need help, put it out there and talk about where your biases are. That might scare the out of some of the people listening. Is there a limit to that, or are there times when you shouldn't do that?
I mean, not all the time, but when it comes down to if I do have a bias, you know, I'll say, now listen, I'm biased towards blah, 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 right? And here's how I feel. So I do put it out there. In terms of when you shouldn't, if it's really impacting how you're viewing something, I think it's helpful for people to understand the why, right? When people understand the why, they are much more clear on what it is they're hearing. And if you don't share the why, and then people find out the why later, then it becomes a little bit of, well, wait a minute, right? Were you just playing us? You know what I mean? Were you trying to manipulate?
I mean, we're talking about smarter collaboration, but we are really talking about collaborative leadership. It is exhibiting a level of trust in your colleagues that you're willing to admit those vulnerabilities and the biases as they exist, knowing that people, or at least believing and trusting that people won't take advantage of them. You know, that's crucial to developing the kind of strong relationships that where smarter collaboration really fosters and leads to the outcomes we were talking about.
When you think about, you know, smart collaboration, it's really hard to collaborate effectively if there isn't clarity on the objective, clarity on the purpose, clarity on the process, right? Clarity on the measurement, right? That will be clarity. I mean, if you have clarity across all those things, now you've actually put people in a position in which they can make decisions, right, based upon what needs to actually happen. The more they understand about that, the more optimal decisions will be. But clarity to me is, if you want collaboration, you have to have really strong clarity.
And then you can trust to empower people because you give them lots of freedom, but it's within the framework that you've already established.
Exactly.
It makes total sense. Okay, let me switch gears because there is an area I want to dig into. Back when you were CEO of Zaplit, you then merged it with MetricStream, where you led the organization for the next, 15 years. So I want you to be thinking about that because in our research on the CVS-Aetna merger, we saw how leaders then pushed the envelope, you know, within regulatory bounds, but they pushed the envelope of getting as much collaboration ahead of time as they could, even to the extent of naming leaders who, you know, should it get approved by the regulators, who would be in charge, right? And it was a risk because at that stage, they were sort of potentially alienating and demotivating people who wished they were still in the running to be leaders. But it also removed a lot of the politicking, right? People didn't have to guess which camp was going to win and those sorts of things. So, you know, we laid that out. I think it aligns really clearly with what you're saying right now, that clarity, the vision, where are we headed? What did you do, post-merger there? When you were CEO, you aimed to foster collaboration, integrating the cultures. What did it take?
So the CEO of the company that we're merging with, right? He and I spent a ton of time together. I mean, a ton. I can't even overemphasize ton of time together before we even decided to do it, right? Because I tell people, listen, mergers are like marriages, all right? Except people don't spend a whole lot of time dating. So is it any surprise that the success rate for mergers is terrible?
Right.
No. To make sure there's alignment around what does success look like, right? Mm-hmm. What do we want? What are we trying to achieve, right? How are we going to decide things? I mean, it's all that stuff you want to decide. And then once you actually engage, yeah, then it's the same thing. It's meeting with team members, talking about it, and then either deciding or at least, again, bringing clarity to what the decision process will be so that there's less anxiety because I don't know what's happening. I don't know how it's going to happen. So we may not have answers, but if we at least share, okay, here's the process, here are the steps.
So I'm thinking back right now, 20 years ago when I was working on my dissertation. And one of the things that we found is that especially under pressure, not necessarily time pressure, but the kind of post-merger type pressure when people are feeling anxious about the future and you feel like lots of eyes on them. One of the things that happened was that rather than relying on actual experts, people who had experience in an area or genuinely had the know-how to get things done, it was natural to defer to looking at somebody's title. And I think in a post-merger situation, when you don't have years of experience, you know, between the two legacy organizations, it would be really tempting to do that. But if you're bringing out the best of everyone, like you were talking about in boards and elsewhere, how can you get people to, you know, go beneath the surface, scratch deeper to figure out what people are truly good at, and then rely on them to make things happen?
You know, it's spending time, especially with the people who will be the senior leaders. It's spending time with them to understand what strengths, weaknesses, you know, et cetera, are. There's one company, when they're looking at acquisitions, you know, et cetera, they put some of the senior leaders through. Actually, you know, it's funny, Heidi. One of the things I tell people all the time is for as much as we focus on and lobby for and negotiate for titles, they're basically meaningless. Because I tell you, I'm the vice president of operations. Do you know what I do? Do you know what my skills are? Yeah, like, no. And by the way, a VP of operations in one company can be completely different in terms of what the roles and responsibilities are in another company. Heck, in the same company, different divisions, it can be different things. So, True. You know, titles really are kind of meaningless. So it's really important to understand underneath it, right? What are the skill sets? What are the roles and responsibilities?
So I heard you say you need to spend time with people. Maybe you can use some tools like formal assessments and things. What have you found are some great questions to ask that help to suss out what somebody's really good at? Do you have a diagnostic question, something that if you get people to answer this, you know, one thing, it really helps you get some insight?
I ask people when they get pulled into other groups, you know, when do people come to you? Right? What's the last time you got pulled into a task force, right? Or a special project? And what role did you play? But mainly it's just trying to get people to tell stories about themselves. A lot of times in stories, you can suss out.
And I think if you listen with both ears, you're probably listening to what they're saying, and then you're, you know, kind of listening of what they're not saying. And I have found that even things like how often they use I versus we, I mean, it's more than semantics.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, for some tips for less listeners, you know, do you have your story ready? Right? I mean, what stories do you have to hand and what are they communicating? I'm not sure, frankly, that most of us are intentional enough about walking around with those in our back pocket, so to speak. Okay, let's rewind again even further. You spent 15 years at IBM and became the first African-American woman sent on an international assignment by the company. That's right, isn't it?
It is. The first executive international assignment.
So what was that experience like? How did collaboration help you earn the opportunity? And how did you leverage collaboration in a cross-cultural setting?
Oh, gosh. The first earning the opportunity was letting people know that I was wanted to do that. that I wanted to do an international assignment. And because if you don't tell people what you actually want to do, they don't know. They can't be defined. Now, you have to have the skills and the support, everything else to make that happen, right? But at least let people know what you want. And so, yeah, being able to actually build the skill sets, people know what I wanted. And then going overseas, the first of all, it was to Japan, all right? Now, you have to understand, my going to Japan, this is in the 90s. My going to Japan, I was about 34, 35 years old at the time. And the average Japanese, like, first-line manager is probably in their 30s. And here I am, the vice president and general manager. And I have a team now across Asia-Pacific, but the gentleman who runs my Asia, my Japanese team, he's probably in his early 60s. And all of a sudden, he's going to be working for a woman, a young woman, a tall young woman who happens to be black. So it's really about, you know, we talk about collaboration. You know, I met with his right-hand person probably 3 times before he and I actually sat down, right? Just to talk about, all right, let's get the agenda straight. Let's understand what we're doing, right? You know, all those kinds of things. And then it was, you know, in order to collaborate, people have to trust you. They have to feel like they know you, right? You have to figure out how to break the ice. And so when I talked to the gentleman who was his right-hand person, his English was pretty good, but it was a little broken. And so he's trying to come up with an analogy. He said, you know, Sally-san, they call me Mr. Sally. You know, Sally-san, you know, this meeting is a nice meeting. It's a get-to-know-you meeting. He said, it's like a first date. And I said, oh, like a first date. Okay. So anyway, I walk into work the next morning, and I walk past a floral shop. And I said, first date. And I literally bought the biggest bouquet of flowers. And I brought them to put them in my cupboard. And when Yamamoto-san came, the gentleman who I was working for, when he came, we met, we bowed. I understand this is our first meeting. Yes, you know, our get-to-know-you meeting. Yes. And Ohara-san said it was like a first date, so I bought you flowers. I pulled out these flowers. And here I am, you know, this young American female, right, handing him flowers for our first date. And at first he looks at me. And he looks at the flowers. And then he burst out laughing. It was the best icebreaker they ever could have been.
Oh, so, that really is.
Collaboration, you have to figure out how are you going to build, right, the trust, the ability for people to get to know you, right, show who you are more than just your title, your role, et cetera. Because if people don't feel they can connect with you, it's going to be really hard for them to collaborate with you.
100%. I mean, I lived in Japan, probably 1990, but I have the, you know, cultural advantage of being short. So at least I had that one on. You know, I see what you mean in terms of, you know, again, you're very consistent, right? In that situation, you could have gone into sort of defense mode, and instead you went out of your way to make him comfortable.
Exactly. That was the idea. It was either going to go very well or very wrong, but I took the risk.
Fantastic. Fantastic. What other gems do you have around collaboration when, you know, when you weren't necessarily in the driver's seat, or at least you were, you know, by title and position in the driver's seat, but you knew you had to get other people on board or you would have been driving an empty bus?
People need to know that you care about them. Right? At the end of the day, that you are trying to take into consideration either what's important to them. And what's important to them might be the learning. It might be the exposure. It could be recognition. For everybody, it's something different. But if you understand, right, what that is, and you demonstrate that you actually care, then I find people actually want to work with you.
The human factor is both the biggest barrier and the biggest opportunity. Yeah, I mean, we see that the ego side of humanity is often what stands in the way. But if you can get past your own ego and help people get past theirs, that's where that connection makes an enormous difference. I know we are probably coming up to time here, but you did for a period of time an Ask Me Anything series on YouTube, which primarily fielded questions about career advice. I want to turn things around a little bit. You were in the position of giving advice, but did you learn anything from that experience from the people you were engaging with?
Absolutely. And by the way, I still do it once a month. And it's really just a way of trying to make myself accessible and sharing what I've learned. So what do I learn? So in the questions, you learn where people are, you learn just how important and impactful first line managers are, right? Or I'll call it direct line. Doesn't say first line, but direct line managers are to people's ability to be successful, to actually contribute. So many questions come through that are really just tied to they don't understand what their boss really wants.
If we can power up that those ranks, I mean, imagine what we could unleash. And yet, so often organizations just aren't willing to make those kinds of investments. So let's figure out how do we scale up these ideas of smarter collaboration, not so that we're being nice to people. I mean, sure, being nice to people is grand, but in a business, you're also trying to get the most out of people. And rather than installing software to try to figure out how many keystrokes they do in a minute, what if we actually empowered them, let them know how we were tapping into everything that they bring to work, and then create the freedom that unleashed them to do their best work? I mean, I think that's where we are headed. And I am just so grateful to you for spending your time helping us think through some of these challenges.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure indeed. Wow. Wasn't that something? At the end of every Smarter Collaboration conversation, we summarize the key takeaways. So here are a few of my thoughts from today. And of course, I'd love to hear your thinking as well. One of the things that Shelley Archambault talked about was vulnerability, not only admitting when you need help, but also mentioning your biases. And I absolutely love this. I mean, for a Black woman executive to show up in a boardroom or anywhere else and start a conversation by saying, I'm going to recap what I learned, but be clear, here's my bias towards X, Y, or Z, and listen to my recap through that lens. I mean, the level of self-awareness that requires and the willingness to be vulnerable and put it out there. That was one of her phrases, put it out there. And show people where you're coming from and that you're not a know-it-all. I thought that advice was just brilliant. And I also thought her advice to not just establish clarity of purpose. I think a lot of leaders hear that and they understand it and they set goals and objectives and a vision. But what Shelley said, which was, I think, novel, is make sure you're telling people the why. Now, a bunch of you are saying, of course, there's 1,000 podcasts out there about, you know, why you should explain the why. But I'm going to challenge you. Do you do it on a day-to-day basis when you're trying to get people to collaborate? This is not the big why of the organization, the meanings, et cetera, et cetera. This is really, why is it that we are tapping into you, the experiences that you have, and the expectations we have for you in this particular moment? That, I think, is something that leaders can really learn from. It's bringing that why into the everyday conversation when you're collaborating with people and helping them understand their role in that bigger purpose. Another thing that Shelley said that sparked a lot of thinking for me is how when she is connecting with people, it doesn't matter if it is her direct reports in Japan or fellow board members in the Fortune 500 boards that she serves on, she is very thoughtful about understanding people's own motivations and connecting with them on their terms. And we have put together a framework that we call ACEs. And when I'm teaching people about influence without authority, so much of collaboration requires us to engage other people and influence them, even when, perhaps especially when, we don't have formal authority over what they do. And so when we're helping people understand how to get that level of influence, we introduce this ACEs concept. It stands for assess, customize, energize, and succeed. And Shelley was at that very first stage of assess. What's it going to take to really grab somebody where it matters to them? Do they care about the money? Do they care about getting ahead in their career? Do they care about leaving a legacy? And what we know is that you can be so much more influential if you connect with people by starting to assess where they're coming from, what matters to them, and then customizing your approach. So I wanted to double click on that because it was a small part of what Shelley said, and yet I think it is such an incredibly powerful part of becoming truly influential in an organization. And the last thing I will say, which many people will believe is common sense, but it doesn't mean it's common practice, is that to establish trust with people, they need to genuinely believe that you care about them as humans, not as workers, not as units of productivity, and certainly not just as ways for you to get ahead in your own ambitions, but really to connect with them and show them that you care about them. That, I think, is a source of power. And Shelley just exudes that level of care and humanity. And I am grateful to Shelley in her wildly busy schedule and incredibly important responsibilities that she's got to share her wisdom with us. So thanks again to our special guest, Shelley Archambault. We appreciate her candor and her insights. As we wrap up this podcast, we want to say, as we always do, remember, you can go faster alone, but you can only go further with others.
We hope that you enjoyed today's Smarter Collaboration show that featured Shelley Archambault. You can visit shelley.com for more information. That's S-H-E-L-L-Y-E. Today's program was produced by Success Made to Last Productions in Austin, Texas, and was created in collaboration with Gardner and Collaborators. Executive producer is Rick Tokini, and today's show was written by Dr. Heidi Gardner, Ivan Matviak, Kristen Dunn, and Rick Tokini. Sound design and post-production were led by Heather Barnes and Carla Tokini. And our operations manager is Marie Ross. This podcast can be heard wherever podcasts are distributed and also on GardnerandCo.co, as well as SuccessMadeToLast.com. And remember, smart collaboration leads to breakthrough outcomes. Have a great week.
Let's talk about Medi-Cal. You have a choice, and Molina makes it easy, especially when it comes to the care you need. So let's talk about you, about making your life easier, about extra help to manage your health. Let's talk about your needs now and for the future. Nobody knows Medi-Cal better than Molina. It starts with a phone call. Call 866-420-5330 or visit meetmolinaca.com. Let's talk today.
If you're a growing business and you've been doing old school accounting, it's time to find the power in your numbers. With Xero, that's Xero spelled X-E-R-O. Xero is accounting software that gives you financial visibility, which helps give you confidence in your business. With automation tools and access to your financial data, it's easy to know your numbers daily, letting you focus on the big picture for your big goals. Learn more at xero.com. Xero, accounting software for better business.